up. I'm here with Phil Gall. We're driving back from Meliodora and just having a bit of a chat. Yeah, so you're saying you were doing some...
Well, in 1970, there was a group of people got together around the... in Collins Street, there was a bookshop called Source, which was selling books, and a lot of the books came from the US, and at that stage there were paperbacks, and up until that point of time, people don't remember, except for Penguin books, most books on technical reference books were hardbacks from England, and they had a stranglehold over the publishing and distribution in Australia, so that a book might be out for 2 years before we could get it in Australia. Well, we got it, it was hardback and expensive. So a chap called Paul Smith and Alex, can't think of his other name, they started the Source Bookshop. And they split up after about a year or two, by which time a group of 12 of us got together with the idea of publishing good news, and we were inspired by Whole Earth Catalogue and Mother Earth News from the States, and we decided that we'd get together and publish a newspaper called Source. And the idea was to publish good news, alternatives, and give ways of dealing with stuff, with the problems. And we believe to acknowledge the worst, but you try to find a positive solution.
I slow down here, oh, 70. Yeah.
Right. And yeah. Paul Smith started up a bookshop called Whole Earth Bookshop up at the top end of Bourke Street. And he had a little weatherboard house with his wife, who earned money being a nurse out of Eltham. And he devised a letterhead and got a business name and sent letters to the US to all the publishers over there. And he eventually went across on the old Fly Now, Pay Later scheme, which used to operate in the late 60s, early 70s. And he went across there with a letterhead and a card he'd had made up, and kind of in America, they were most impressed, and he told his vision and his aim, and they gave him a credit to actually import books and pay when they were sold, unlike the British publishing houses. And so he was importing these books, and his address and his where was a little weatherboard house in Eltham, which in the United States they didn't know, and he called a company, Whole Earth Books, and that was alongside us starting a newspaper. And in Collins Street, above the Via Veneto Cafe, we had a room up there that we rented, and we started to get copy for different things. And we used to have about a 32-page newspaper, tabloid size, and we did articles on everything from apprenticeship to chemicals in agriculture and under houses, and we interviewed government departments, and we interviewed industries like DuPont and ICI and Hearst. And one of the tasks that I had, because I was interested in environment and done some work in, I trained as an architect, and was most interested in landscape architecture and environmental ecological things. So I had the hat of environment. So I went to a natural farming conference, which was as a rep for Source, down at Painesville. And I was fortunate, because I never heard the names before, but for little micro cassettes for 3 days, I got such a wealth of information by hearing Alex Podolinski, Biodynamics, P.A. Yeobans, the Key Line, and Peter Bennett, mineral fertilizer, dolomite promoter, and organic gardener and farmer from South Australia. Well, my mind was open, and they had the usual representatives of the chemical companies of, and Pivot, the fertilizer people, and government departments, the Department of Ag, and the farmers that had a drought for 3 years at Swifts Creek and Omeo, right up from Bairnsdale right up to the Omeo, and they noticed things about their land and about the animals, and they had some questions they wanted answered, because they started to talk to each other for the first time in generations, because they shared shearing, they shared fence repairing, they learned how to spin wool, they learned how to salt and cure meat, because they were getting a dollar for their lambs, because the drought was so bad, and they didn't just want to dig a hole and bury them if they could have some alternative. And so they started talking with each other, and they noticed that since they couldn't afford the DDT, couldn't afford the dieldrin, couldn't afford all those chemicals, the crop sprayers used to spray near the Mitchell River, and the two crop dusters, two brothers, they both had one side of their body on their leaning out the plane with ticks and paralysis down one side of their body from spraying this crap out of the plane. So they wanted to have answers to, the fish were mutating in the Mitchell River, and people suddenly realised without the sprays, the mutated fish were disappearing and the fish were becoming normal. They noticed the less scouring of the animals when they weren't having superphosphate, very bright green grass, and the native grasses came back, and the sheep were stronger, apart from lack of water, but less scouring, less infertility, generally the sheep were healthier and less diarrhea, whatever they call that in sheep, and too much green matter, too much superphosphated grass. But they didn't know what the answers were, but they knew that they'd observed that there was a general health in the native grasses and the sheep that were eating the native grasses. The only reason the sheep being thin and dying was just lack of water with a drought and lack of feed, and some of the farmers couldn't afford to import food. So they called this natural farming conference. And I went down to Painsville with my partner, and I recorded on little cassettes, micro cassettes, all the goings on. And I met P.A. Yeomans and Podolinski and became enamoured of this way of thinking. And it was a 3-day conference, and after 2 days, all the chemical people, all the artificial fertiliser people, and the government people, they left. They couldn't take the heat, not because the other proponents, the P.A. Yeomans and Podolinski and Bennett, they never attacked or insulted them at all. But the others were casting aspersions on organics and on key line, and that they were derisive of what they were doing, and saying, oh, you can't feed the world by this, and you can't feed the world organically. And meanwhile, the farmers were listening attentively to the wisdom of these elders, who were giving them example after example of how things worked and why they worked, giving simple explanations that the farmers could understand. And so there's a whole spate of people adopting key line and organics and cutting out these dreadful chemicals up in the Omeo Swifts Creek. It lasted about a generation, and then people gradually fell back into other ways, a lot of them. But there's still some left today of the people that were influenced by that, or the kids influenced by that. So that was 1971 when that conference happened. Now, I learned from P.A. Yeomans, used to travel around the countryside and watch how he read the landscape and how he designed dams and how he improved the soil with his wonderful chisel plough, which didn't upturn the clay on the top and didn't expose the soil to the sun and the rain and melt hell out of it. And Podolinski, I went to Podolinski's workshops and his farming days and joined the Biodynamic Gardeners Association. And I was a cynic about biodynamics to start with. And it took me 3 or 4 years and trial and error. And when I did it myself, I tasted the food, I grew it, I used the BD sprays, I did trials with or without it. And I compared the longevity of the food, the taste of it. And then various laboratories around Melbourne used to do tests of the nutrient value of the food. Of course, tried to get it published in the newspapers, but it wasn't allowed to be published. Department of Agriculture did their own tests on the difference between biodynamic, organic and chemical food. Once again, it was held in house, and only for internal publication. It wasn't allowed to put in the newspapers. And that was under the government of Henry Bolte and Arthur Ryler, who were kind of nasty types. So it was like a police state, but people didn't realise it. And I did an article at the Source newspaper after this time on all the chemicals we don't need in agriculture and under people's houses. I quoted World Health statistics. I gave examples of some parts of Gippsland where there was an undue number of babies born deformed and stillbirths. And I researched it all out, and I got the chemical names of some of these brands of chemicals that we didn't really need to use. And I published the addresses and the phone numbers of the managing directors of all these organisations, of the chemical companies and that, the representatives in Melbourne. I got the names of the people from the government department who were willing. They were willing to give us their names and their phone numbers, address for people to have more information. Noxious weeds and vermin people, they were dreadful. And even the state rivers people, they were allowing stuff in the rivers that we wouldn't allow today. Anyway, so it was a four-page lift out. Previously we'd done one on apprenticeship, and the same thing happened, shit at the fan. Mm-hmm. People objected. Before we knew where we were, we had threatening phone calls. We had unknown...
Sorry, left.
Unknown people in... unknown people with hats down over their ears and big shoulders with suits and looking like wrestlers. Turning up and saying that they were from Spring Street, from the government, the parliament, from the state government up there. And we had turning out our files and looking at that. And then one day we ran home from a special meeting on a Saturday to wonder what we'd do with all these threats and all these to close us down and one thing or another like that. And we went home. A young colleague, David, had stayed in a little garret right up on top, and he got in the middle of the night to go to the toilet, and he found himself in the middle of the night just hanging there by a doorway, and the floor underneath was blown away. And they had old gas pipes from the early part of the century there. We thought, oh, there was been a gas pipe, an explosion, and it transpired over the next 24 hours that Fire Brigade came, the police came, and we got there, and the Fire Brigade was hosing down all our files. All our files were open downstairs, and all the drawers open, and they were wicking all the papers, hosing down. And so I said, what are you doing? I said, oh, we've got instructions from police to do this. And we knew a couple of policemen, uniform police from D24, because we used to try to find places for kids on the street and people as refuges, people escaping violence and that. And we had this couple of wonderful police in their 60s that were friends of ours and that would say, well, we've got these kids, they need a place here. Can you, with your network and part of a group called Link Up and the Brown Paper at the time, which we used to cut and paste community news. And one we had this network and we told them about it. They didn't know anything about it. They had no ideas what was going on. They inquired for us and said, look, guys, I said, this is really dangerous. I said, these instructions come from the top of the government here. And they pointed right up to Spring Street, to State Parliament, and said, they come from the top, that at all costs you're going to be closed down, that you're dangerous. I said, they said, if they could have, they would have had the old laws of treason, because you're writing and upsetting the apple cart. So then we found out from these uniformed police that what had actually transpired was that it was deliberate. It wasn't the gas pipes at all. But they got a shock that they didn't know there was anyone in the place. They waited until we all left. It didn't account for David, who had asthma, and he didn't want to ride his bike home. That he went upstairs to a little garret, with a little kitchen and a toilet right up the top. They didn't know anyone would stay there. And so a big shock went through the system. So we were advised by our well-wishers and people that cared what we were doing, look guys, you better go quiet, you better undercover for a while. So and subsequently we had, in those days we had typewritten or handwritten copies of everything because we cut and pasted all our newspaper. And luckily we had some left over which wasn't all wet. And so we just went into our own homes and all that, and we had meetings between us, and a lot of our copy went into things like Grassroots, Earth Garden, and a thing called Revolution, and High Times, and some of it went into the first surfing magazine. What was that called? Trax. So various articles on health and nutrition, articles on chemicals in food you don't need, and chemicals in agriculture. But I just published all the statistics about 245D and 245T, things called berry killer, people were using with gabapentin and what it actually did to the nervous system and what it did to plants and uptake with mammals. And I also talked about what was Roundup and stuff like that, or the equivalent to Monsanto stuff. And course, we were a great thorn in the side of people that got away with just... And Bolte and Ryler had practiced strict censorship, and they had their ways and means of shutting people up and closing them down. Which way?
Left.
So we sat on that. We then were a part of, involved with starting Nimbin, and we did things like go to Jigalong, and at the request of Aboriginal Society, once Gough got in, a lot of us were helping to get Gough Whitlam in, the Labor Party in, and we're changing the divorce and environmental consideration and Aboriginal rights and the Arts Council and value and free education and Medicare. And we were fighting for that for 3 or 4 years all over Australia. But it was just, we were particularly active in Melbourne in a group, in a core group that I knew. And so one thing led to another, and then I went to the desert and living with Aboriginal people and building a workshop and teaching silversmithing, and so they can make jewellery out of the semi-precious stones, so they can earn an income which they can post these things away interstate, because a lot of their sculpture was too heavy to post away, and they were getting ripped off by miners from Mount Newman, giving a flag and a sherry for a work of art, of beautiful craftwork with a shield that would take them a month to make. And then they were, of course, having alcoholic issues, because a flag and a sweet sherry wasn't the best for anyone, you know, particularly with two people using it over one night, you know. And so that was our experience. So I came back from that, and we started up, bought the land at Thunderbolt Falls at Nimbin, and then through the 70s we had Terania Creek and Bellingen and communities starting up over that, and out of Christmas Hills, outside Kangaroo Ground, community starting up over there. And there was a consciousness around about the change and how we could recycle and reuse. And we started down to earth workshops, and Friends of the Earth Food Co-op in early 70s in a terrace house in Nicholson Street, and then RMIT Food Co-op, we got that going back in the late 60s, early 70s, and there's things happening all over the place, and people trying to learn all about organics. And and then one day I got a phone call from this guy called Bill Mollison, and I was doing landscaping and building, and I was building dams with Yeomans.
At the crossing up there.
And I was building dams with Yeomans, and I was learning about biodynamics and using 500 and all the preps. And I was here years ago. This is where Bruce Hedge... places.
Yeah, I think so. Know. Somewhere around here.
Yeah, I did
his rocks over there.
Oh yeah, I did his dam.
Okay.
Years ago, 1979, and one way or another, Bill Mollison rang and said, "Oh, I've just had an interview with Terry Lane. Did you hear it?" I said, "No, I've been working landscaping," and he said, "Terry says I should speak to you because you're doing what I talk about." And he said, "I don't believe it." I said, "Well," I said, "would you like to talk about it?" He said, "Oh, possibly." I said, "Where are you?" "So I'm in Melbourne." I said, "We're in Hawthorne." I said, "Hop in a taxi or a train and come out and have dinner with us." So then he stayed the night on the couch, and then ended up staying for 2 weeks, and I took him around and showed him key line jobs I'd done, and companion planting and integrating landscaping with ecology and landscaping with vegetables and fruit trees, and how you could have the best of aesthetics and landscape. And I was mulching, doing all those sensible organic ecological principles. And he said, right now, he said, "We've got a book," he said, coming out. He said, "You can help me launch it." And in Collingwood, Clifton Hill actually, on the edge of the Merrick Creek, the council gave him a bit of land and said, "Well, you can use this to have a demonstration there's a lot of mini area, and then you can plant these trees. And so I raced around Melbourne getting all the advanced fruit trees that really needed repotting, prune them and put them in the ground. And then 2 weeks later in the pouring rain, we launched Permaculture One. And
where did you launch it? It's serious.
No, it was off Heidelberg Road in Clifton Hill.
Okay.
On the edge. It's still the Merry Creek, but it's a lot further downstream than, yep, than that. And meanwhile, I took Bill, introduced him to all the inner suburb councils around Melbourne, to Richmond and Collingwood and Fitzroy and Moreland, Brunswick, and introduced him to some of the people at Melbourne University and Burnley College. There's a biodynamic person teaching a Dutchman who grew potatoes and whitloaf out of Kinglake. He was all biodynamic, and he was a lecturer at Burnley, one of the few, and a bit of a closet biodynamics in those days. You didn't admit you were into biodynamics. As Bill used to say derisively, you don't need fairies to grow food. And which is a good throwaway line, but it's not quite accurate. That's what biodynamics stands for. And then, of course, I sat introduced Bill to Yeomans on one day, because Yeomans used to come down and visit me, and I'd go around the jobs with him, and he and Podlinski refused to talk to each other. Alex Podlinski said bar about permaculture, and Bill said bar about biodynamics, and it took the generation of David and that generation, and I'm a bit older than David, but it took our group to integrate. We are the integrators. Those Yeomans and Podlinski and Peter Bennett and Bill Mollison, they are the solo flyers that take no prisoners and have a single-minded focus, blinkers on, so no one deters them from their path. They can't be persuaded and dilute their vision. And that's fine. I think there's a need for that, and that passion and that single-mindedness. But beyond that, it came for a time for application and adapting on scale, adapting in different climates, which David always has proposed, by the way, and integration. And so my generation thought about, let's use mineral fertilizers, let's see what's this about the magnetic benefits of different kinds of rock dust. Yeah, that's interesting. Let's use soil test appropriately, and let's not just take the fertilizer companies people of how much NPK you need. We said, well, do we need it in the first place, or is the way we can encourage the soil to release it and the plants? And so we went back to some of the old-fashioned medieval and European ideas, which biodynamics borrows from the ancient traditions, and permaculture borrows from the ancient tradition of tribal ways of doing things, because permaculture offered a design method, design philosophy, a way of consciously creating landscapes and using the traditional techniques, and not just being bound by tradition, but actually picking and choosing. So so it was exciting. So I met Bill, and as I said the other day at Vini's funeral, I met Vini before I met David.
Yep.
And she was kept her name quiet when she came as a visitor to one of my courses, and she kept coming back as a guest. And I said, you're most welcome, Vinnie. She asked really intelligent questions, and she was a great analytical thinker. I started a course at Panton Hills in 1978 called Land, Plant and Water. And I just read the book, the Permaculture One book, and it fitted in perfectly with some of my own ideas, but I liked some of the structures and some of the ideas and the detail I hadn't thought of. And so subsequently, Vinnie said to me, well, look, you've met Bill and you've got the books here, but you've got to meet David. And I said, I want to. Don't worry about it, man. Let it go. And I don't know how it happened, but I went over to Jackie's Marsh, and we had about 5 or 6 days together up at Western Tiers, the place he lived in, and we talked about the vision and the practicality and how it takes some years to get enough examples on the ground. And I talked at the time about the principle of timing, and how I said have an idea before the critical mass of people are ready to accept it. Before there aren't enough examples on the ground, I said it can easily bloom and then die for a while before it comes back. And they said, I've been feeling the same way. He said, I worry about that. And it was true that after the initial course in 81 and everyone rushing around, people were at a bit of a loss to know where to find examples to do things, and people were trying to apply Permaculture 1, Permaculture 2 books literally, and people were misapplying them in different climates and different kinds of soil and that, and the nuances which David talks about with examining the soil and all that are needed to be found. And it took another 4 or 5 years before it came alive. Can we pause for a moment? I'm on tablets for fluid reduction, so my heart doesn't end up with gusto and something else. So my heart doesn't get fluid around it.
Yeah.
The idea of critical mass and timing was well summed up in 1995 at the Adelaide Permaculture Conference. There's a guy called Robert, someone, a sociologist from USA. He was from an intentional community. We can look up what his name is and that, but he showed a graph. And he talked about the importance of timing and critical mass in any movement continue to grow. And he pointed out that with Alex Polisi, for example, he waited 20 years before he would allow the ABC or anyone to do a television program or even a radio program on biodynamics, because he said, no, we're not ready yet. And he waited till he had enough examples of farms and gardens throughout Australia and a critical mass of people who are aware of how biodynamics really works, the practical application of it, to get out of the myth, muck and magic appearance from the public at large. But also, he said, we don't need a critical mass of awareness of the value of it. We need to have a critical mass awareness that there's a great need for it. And when people's economic inheritance, like the soil, is disappearing, and when people find they can't run the farm and they've got the chance of having to lose the farm, he said, when people are desperate is the best time for people to learn. And people learn best when they ask the questions themselves, not when they're browbeaten and taught something that they can't see the relevance for. So Alex used to say that. And this guy was saying, well, the reason why biodynamics succeeded because they were patient and waited until they had the critical mass. And in 1985, Alex thought it was time, and he argued and had a contract and a lawyer with the ABC that they wouldn't change one word, one piece of music, one photograph, or edit his work. That before it went to print, he had to see the final print, and they gave him full editorial control, because this is so important that it is not misrepresented as some kooky New Age thing, you know?
Mm.
And the ABC, with pressure from people for decades, that have a program on biodynamics, this is great. They had such pressure from the public, and even within their ranks of people that knew about the value of this, that they agreed. And it was the only time they ever agreed to full editorial thing. And A Winter's Tale appeared on A Big Country, which doesn't exist anymore, in 1985 on ABC TV. And it was requested and requested and requested so many times. The ABC, they had the greatest number of inquiries had ever had to a rural program, A Big Country, or anything like that ever. And it's a beautiful, I recommend everyone gets it. It's on video, it's available, I think, on the net. Which way, mate?
A left, sorry.
And so I saw it, and I was so rapt. And there's a wonderful story apropos of that, there's a chap called Kent Broad. Straight ahead?
Yep.
And Kent Broad and his wife and three little kids are farmers in the wheat and sheep belt in Western Australia. In fact, I went to visit him when I went to the after the APC International in 96. He, when he saw this program, it was just a short time after they'd buried his mother and his dad's wife, and they found out that she died of toxicity from chemicals, that he and his dad, with masks on and with gloves and all that, had been spraying agriculturally, they didn't know any better, for more than a decade. And the house was in the middle of a property on a hill, and she'd be hanging out the washing windows open, cooking like that, and they didn't know enough about it to know, they didn't know how lethal it was. And
well, they were wearing gloves and masks, though.
I know, no, but they didn't know that, they thought that they were doing it a long way from the house, not realising about the drift.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the drift uphill, because the lay of the land, it was just a peculiar situation of the land. Normally that distance wouldn't affect, but they thought they had the gloves and the mask because of splashing and things like that on the face. They didn't realise that actually in the air it was dangerous, you know, that it was a splashing. Like, these chemical companies infer a lot, but don't actually tell you a lot in those days. What was written on the outside was poisons. Do not drink. Do not let your hand, bare skin, you know. Protect your skin, protect your eyes.
Yeah.
Right here?
Yep.
I went to Pylon once.
That's where I go to get the combi fixed.
Ah. So, anyway, so... So Kent Broad and his dad was absolutely destroyed by the realisation when they found a medical doctor who specialised in toxicology when they were trying to investigate what was wrong with his wife, why she had this cancer. He gave them a full report on it, but it wasn't in time to do anything. It was too late by that stage. So his father was broken and was just sitting staring into space, and Kent was going to take over the farm, and he rang up Alice Podolinski, and he said, I want you to come out and look at the farm. We want to convert to biodynamics. And Alex said, I'm sorry, I can't do it for 3 or 4 months. And Kent broke down in tears on the phone, and Alex paused and said, what's up? He said, oh, just buried Mum last week or a short time ago. He said, we found out that she died from cancer caused by chemicals that Dad and I have been spraying on the crops, and that we didn't actually know they were so lethal and so bad and in the air. And he said, I don't know what to do. And he said, I saw the winter's tail. Alex, listen, while he said, you've got accommodation? He said, and he said, just feed me. He said, don't worry, I'll get myself there. He said, I'll see you in 2 days' time. So he flew out, and another biodynamic farmer was over to take him up to Kent's place. And that day on, Kent started the whole process, and he put 2/3 of his property in recovery. He decided to go fencing and shearing to earn extra quid, renegotiated with the bank. Luckily they owned 70% of their farm. Had a good bank manager whose actual brother was an ecologist and who understood organics. So the bank manager was in favour of that. And so he fenced off an area which the sheep used to get in, which had become salt encrusted, which a lot of Western Australia does. He fenced it off and he just sprayed 500 twice a year in the traditional BD method, just... And he that he used the preparations of 500 and mostly 500, and then eventually the salt disappeared and the clover salt tolerant species came up, some of the salt bush species, and clover came back. The river reed gum started to regenerate. The wetland returned. The birds started to come. Birds ate the locusts. Locusts didn't decimate the crops. The whole landscape changed. Meanwhile, it took 3 years to be half converted, and eventually it was 5 years altogether because we had a full clearance from any kind of chemicals on the land. And they used sacrificial cropping and green manuring and all the best techniques that biodynamics and organics can put in, and made huge compost heaps and using the hay and cut grass and all that. And then 10 years later, Kent still only operates two-thirds of his property at any one time, and he has at least a third of it in recovery, which is the holistic resource management technique. Not resting, it's actually recovering. There's a difference. So you consciously grow stuff on it so that it recovers biologically as well. It's not just rested, takes the animals off it. And he got twice the amount for his biodynamic wool overseas. He got three times the price for his biodynamic wheat overseas that he was getting before. So, and instead of spending $30,000 a year on fertilizer and chemicals, which they were doing for their 3,000 acre or whatever it was property, maybe it's 3,000 hectares, I can't remember that, but it's a big property. But anyway, instead of spending $30,000, he was spending about $500 a year on biodynamic preps and occasionally a mineral dust or mineral top-up. So he was literally, the bank manager was happy. There was a perfect precedent for banks in that area saying, well, anyone wants to convert to organics and biodynamics, now go and see Kent Broad, come up with a business plan and we'll look at you. The Rural Bank of Western Australia was a great bank before it got wrecked in the global system and taken over or became only commercial. The Rural Bank of Western Australia, the rural banks of all the states were like the state housing banks, set up not to make a profit at any cost, but to actually help people with farming or help people with owning their own house, you know. And so it's one of those wonderful examples I read about, and I was lucky enough to go and visit them in 96, and well, just so thrilling, you know. And we talked to him about key lime, we talked to him about permaculture as well, because too many farming properties had areas of the land that were eroded near the gate and it pooled in winter. And so any farm that is organic or biodynamic can still benefit from key lime. Get the water in the right place at the right time. And also the permaculture thing of resilience and diversity is another thing. And so Kent, because of his experience with, he had the social cultural interrupter in his life and in his business, and so he was then able to be radical to look for resilience in the system. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so I was then really happy to be in the position to be able to attempt as a designer, you know, putting together architecture, landscape architecture and biodynamics. And I subsequently did a biodynamic farming course when years later it was offered, and I was recovering from a heart operation and I couldn't work full time, and I went back to work too quickly in 88, and so by 91 I took the chance to get my dip ed. I had a technical teachers college certificate before from the 60s, so I did my dip ed half time then, and then went back to work again, and had a bit of chronic fatigue again because my body wasn't up to it. So I cut out of that, and then in 96 I did the biodynamic farming course at Warrenwood and revisited and became a bit more adept and skilled at the nuances. But I have tried biodynamics and I have compared it scientifically. I've done all these trials with colleagues, all of us being scientifically rational, trusting in physics and chemistry from our rational upbringing from the 50s at school. But I learned through trial and error and experimentation and being lucky to make a radical change in my own life in the late 60s, early 70s, and go into communities and trial all these different systems. And so I just feel blessed that I discovered biodynamics and Keyline and Peter Bennett with his dolomite use and sensibility with our rock minerals.
So is that linked to the Albrecht kind of approach?
I discovered Albrecht after that. As a result of going here, I discovered Albrecht from, what's that news that there's an Australian version of that comes from the States?
Acres,
yeah. So through Acres, I discovered Albrecht method. It overlaps,
yep.
And they link in together. And but I've realised there's so much to learn and so many subtle nuances and variations. And every 4 or 5 years, someone would innovate somewhere in Australia or elsewhere in the world, and we say, wow, now that's a subtle variation of this, and this fits this situation better than what we've known before.
Mm.
Look at that wonderful landscape of those boulders.
I love this spot
right here. Isn't that beautiful?
This is my favourite spot right here. Right here where you're stopping.
My God,
I drive down here and it's just like...
The gorgeous. the energy of that hill with those beautiful granite boulders.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
We're just out of pylon.
Unfortunately, it's been overgrazed with animals. It needs a bit of recovery. It needs to have a bit of it hived off and let recover.
Every time I drive down here, I just think this spot's gorgeous.
So where are we geographically?
We're in between Lancefield and Pylong. Probably about 5 km out of Pylong.
So does the area have a name? Is it Pennines or is it part of the Great Dividing?
I'm not sure.
Oh, it reminds me of Henry Moore's sculptures in the sheep country south of Glasgow.
Yeah.
The English sculptor who did these huge stone sculptures, and you look out there, it looks like a boulder, and he did these huge bronzes of kings and queens. About 3 times normal heights on a ridge with all the sheep around underneath. beautiful.
It is, isn't it?
But nature is so powerful. Like it's almost like those rocks are bastions guarding the earth. And, you know, it's like random chess pieces over the hill.
I love this little spring dam.
A little spring dam, yes. Wow. What a delight.
It's always water in that dam.
So one thing leads to another, and well, that's a nice rock there. Look at that one. Yeah. And the Aboriginal elders, Hillis Maris, who I did some work with in the early 80s, and we looked at land in Goulburn where she wanted to establish a youth hostel kind of outward bound kind of thing for the some of the lost Aboriginal kids in urban Melbourne and go out there. We looked at some land up in the highlands above the Goulburn River, Parchier, and I said, oh, these granite boulders here, aren't they fantastic? I said, feel the energy. She said, you feel it, Phil, we feel it, but not many white fellas feel it. And he said, so that's why I want you to look at the land. And I said, well, I can't understand how you can't feel the energy from these rocks. He said, well, some people have not tuned that. He said, I noticed you took your shoes off to walk in this land. She said, what did you do that for? I said, oh, I don't know. I've always done that. He said, tuned up black fella in my skin. I said, that's a wonderful compliment you pay me, Hillis, but I can't claim that. He said, you've got the same heart as black fella. I can tell by the way you treat the land.
Mm.
And so it's a wonderful gift of cult which he gave me, because I always had that since I was a kid, but I was always considered a bit weird amongst my whitey west coast of Tasmania. locals. And so that was Hillis Maris said, Aboriginal, it was always sort of so funny that people built Melbourne down on the mud flats, and one of the permanent there said, blackfellas, we used to come down from the granite country from all around the place, from the Yu Yangs and down from Hillsville and all the rocky bit, Hanging Rock and all those places, said, we come down only in summer to the mud flats, spring and summer, for the fish and for the water and for the life. But in winter time, much healthier living in the granite country. Granite country is the best for your health. I said, what's the second best? He said, sandstone, like around Sydney. And I said, what's the next? He said, basalt. I said, the worst is shale mudstone clay for people to live permanently on. I said, why is that? He said, you get arthritis. You get asthma. She said, the land doesn't breathe enough. I thought, wow, it may be simplistic, but there's a lot of truth from my own experience in that. Like when we lived in Colbeck, Mum and Dad lived on what was a reclaimed, half of the flat part of Colbeck is reclaimed swamp, reclaimed wetlands. And of course, yabbies came up through the lawn, and Mum had bronchitis, and lots of people had bronchitis, and a lot of people kind of had asthma. I'm not saying it's simple cause and effect, but my experience is that I feel high as a kite when I live amongst granite and boulders and hills and mountains.
I've always found them majestic.
Yes.
Yeah. And this is my favourite part of granite country. It's around here. Up around Tallarook, there's some amazing granite boulders too.
Well, if you go from Seymour towards Yay, you cross over the Goulburn River near Yay.
Yeah,
there's a place called Highlands.
Yeah, yeah.
And I helped design a simple timber platform between three huge two-story high granite boulders. And we designed is it called plexiglass? It was acrylic. We got it cut especially to a profile to fit it amongst the rocks, and put silicon, and we got a rubber seal and silicon. Put this plexiglass like a big like the turret of a bomb turret in an aircraft. We put that between the rocks on two sides. On one side we had a wooden door which was made like a piece of sculpture to fit in the rocks, and the plexiglass went curved back and above, so it was the roof as well as the windows.
Yeah.
And it was just a little wooden deck, and the person who had a house, an old-fashioned California kind of expansive bungalow, well built back in the 30s, lower down. He used to go up there as a retreat and just as a little reading meditation place up there. But those boulders were so inspiring in the Highlands. And I don't know if I could ever find it again, but you know the Highlands Road I'm talking about?
Yeah.
That's not far as the crow flies from Seymour,
no,
is it?
No. That up. That was good.